there will be, projections are that there will be 2 billion cars on the roads by 2035. And as we've talked about in the past, right now, the human population around the world is burning 99.9 million barrels of oil every single day of the year. And I think I've given you an appreciation for how much that is as far as content. But if you take 99.9 million barrels of oil, the average barrel of oil is about 20 inches across the diameter of the barrel. And it's a 42-gallon drum, essentially. And if you put them side by side, 99.9 million barrels of oil would create a belt over 20, in fact, somewhere around 30,000 miles. In other words, around the equator of the world. The equator, of course, is 25,000 miles. And right now, with 99 million barrels of oil, that would even give you an extra 5,000 miles, I suspect. So that kind of gives you an understanding that we're burning a lot of oil, and that oil is literally dissipating in the atmosphere, the biosphere of this planet, in carbon dioxide, particulate, and of course all the other gases that go with it. And that's not all of it. The processing of crude oil takes an extraordinary amount of energy and burning that is also part of the pollution and part of the carbon footprint that goes into the biosphere 24/7. So what I want to really talk about is the ramifications of all of these automobiles and what they're doing. I don't have the facts and figures right now, but I think, I'm pretty sure, as I've been researching, automobiles kill tens of thousands of people every year around the world. I'm not sure it's quite 100,000 people are killed on the highways of the world, but you can look it up. And in fact, I may look it up during this hour with you, but I'm pretty sure it's pretty close to 100,000, because I know in the United States, we lose somewhere around nearly 20,000 people get killed on the highways of America every year. Obviously, you can imagine with the Chinese adding 27 million new cars to their highways every year, they are probably having just as many deaths or more in China. The same thing going on in Europe, the same thing going on in the big cities in Canada, and also in Australia. So these cars, these automobiles, these trucks, all of these modern conveniences are not only killing a lot of people, but they're also doing a tremendous amount of damage to the planet. But also understand that all of the oil that is used, and again, as we talked about before, the predictions are that we'll be burning 200 million gallons of oil literally every day by 2030, which is only 11 years from now. And I'm going to quote you two aspects of what we're really facing, and that's world gridlock traffic. Ben Elton wrote in Gridlock, and I quote, "A society sufficiently sophisticated to produce the internal combustion engine has not had the sophistication to develop cheap and efficient public transportation. There are hardly any buses, the trains are hopelessly underfunded, and hence the entire population is stuck in traffic." And of course, you all know it here in the United States as gridlock traffic. I'm just outside of Denver, and I can tell you every time I go into Denver, a city of 2.5 million people, it's a nightmare, because you know you're going to run into bumper-to-bumper gridlock traffic, average over 30 accidents a day. And so it's just a matter of time before you become a victim of the accidents of Denver. Can you imagine what it's like in Los Angeles with 11 million people? or in New York City with 8.3 million people, or Chicago with around 4 to 5 million people, Atlanta, Miami, the list goes on. And so here is another quote from my own experiences in traffic in Hong Kong, which I've traveled through, in Tokyo, which is a nightmare, Sao Paulo in South America, Sydney, Australia, I've been there, Houston, Paris, I've been there, New York, Los Angeles, I've been through there, Chicago, I've been into Beijing, I've been through Shanghai, Atlanta, San Francisco, and dozens of other overpopulated cities. I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, having been there, that it is a complete nightmare, and it only gets worse as we continue to add population. And as I've said, I want to remind you that the human race adds 80 million new babies net gain every year. In fact, I think last year it was 83 million. And I'm quoting here about gridlock traffic. Quote, gridlock traffic causes more deaths, more tension, more suffering, and more emotional misery than is yet understood. It defeats the human spirit with endless failure of the ability to move forward. You can be killed or maimed at any moment by another automobile driver. Drivers fume in their seats while their cars fume up the biosphere. Gridlock traffic worsens by the year as humanity grows its collective population by 80 million net gain. Gridlock traffic can never be solved as long as humans refuse to address the root cause of the problem, colon, human overpopulation, unquote. I think that's a very powerful quote. I think it's a very appropriate quote. And I think it's going to, as you can imagine, it simply can only get worse as that's how and what we're facing. Now, I'm going to go over some of the figures here in America, but take them wherever you are and just stick them into your particular situation. On average, 40,000 Americans lose their lives every year in traffic crashes. In Denver, Colorado, where I live, gridlock traffic accounts for 25 to 30 crashes every day of the week. To put Denver's traffic into a few words, an exasperating daily living nightmare. And of course, there, according to Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, a total of 14 million drivers drive drunk on America's highways 24 hours a day. I want you to hear that again. 14 million American drivers drive drunk. In other words, over the minimum limit of being 20, and that's 365 days a year. You might go to warning for an auto crash that takes your life or places you in the ICU at a local hospital. When you start thinking about how many people are on drugs, and now that we're legalizing marijuana across the United States. I mean, I think New York State's now working to legalize marijuana. Marijuana has been legalized in Denver. It's in Washington State, I believe, and a few other states. Well, these kids today who lack any understanding or appreciation for personal accountability and personal responsibility are also out there with those 14 million drunks, and they're stoned. And I'm a baby boomer myself. I got stoned in my 20s, and I know exactly what it's like to be stoned. You're not in control of your mind. You're off somewhere in an alternative universe. If you're cocained up, you're also in an alternative universe. If you are using any kind of drugs of any kind to alter your brain, or you're on sedatives, or you're on some kind of painkiller. So we have millions of people that are on the highways of America and in Canada and in Europe that are incapable of driving, and yet they are driving.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, by all means.
You know, I certainly see your problem and your difficulty, but how do you control that? I mean, with alcohol, there's certainly, you know, the alcohol tests and things like that that they can do when they pull people over, but you know, with things like sedatives and marijuana, how can they test for that? And you know, I mean, I understand that marijuana can be used for a lot of things, and it can mute kind of your consciousness to a certain degree if you've smoked too much of it. So it should be against the law to drive while under the influence of that as well. But how are they going to legislate that?
It would be very simple, actually. I've actually done everything I can here in Colorado to bring very prohibitive laws into effect. You should, when you gain your driver's license at the age of 16, you should sign a piece of paper and also watch a movie that shows all of the consequences of driving drunk or driving stoned and a lot of the accidents, and show people's, you know, bodies and mangled lives and so forth. But you should sign, or be forced to sign, if you're going to enjoy the privilege of driving. And that is, if you are caught drinking and driving, you lose your license for a minimum of 5 years the first time, and a $20,000 or $30,000 fine. In other words, you make the consequences so prohibitive that nobody in their right mind would drink and drive. And you also lose your car, and you have to pay for the car being stored for those 5 years. Well, you can't use it. And if you a friend lets you drive a car, that person also loses their car for that period of time. So that'll stop anyone from lending their car to somebody who's going to drink and drive. I think the same thing would work if you are using marijuana or any mind-altering drug. And so what you do, and then, of course, your insurance rates would just be unbelievable. I don't care what they are, $20,000 a year or more. So you make the consequences so prohibitive that once these 14 million people who are drunk on the highways 24/7 in the United States start finding their, and then if they then drink or then they take their license, even though the license is gone, and then they drive again, then they're facing jail time. And that would be the way to solve it, because obviously nothing else has solved drinking and driving in this country. Nothing thus far has solved marijuana smoking and driving. And so the only way to deal with it would be a very harsh, prohibitive way of taking the car away and literally taking your driver's license. And if you do it a third time, a second time, your driver's license is gone for 10 years. And then a third time, your license is gone for the rest of your life. And of course, you would be in jail absolutely automatically for a 1 to 3 year period. I mean, that's the kind of consequences that people listen to and then actually would adhere to. And then the ones that don't, they are going to be sitting in jail, which I'll be happy to pay their three meals a day in a cot, because I don't want my kids and I don't want my wife in an accident by somebody who's drunk and or stoned, and they kill my family members. I'm willing to pay the jail fees for those kinds of individuals. Does that make any sense?
It makes a great deal of sense. Is this something the state would legislate, or would this be a federal legislation?
I personally would like to see it to be a state, but also a federal legislation, so that everyone had to comply no matter what. One way or the other, I guarantee you that if we had that kind of law on the books, we would drop there's right now, I think last year was 17,000 deaths from alcohol on America's roadways. And it would stop all of the other injuries. I mean, think of there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of injuries. We need to be, I do the same thing with cell phones. If you're caught texting on the highways, because right now 11,000 texting accidents each year and 4,100 deaths from texting messages while driving 60 and 70 miles an hour. So I would put the same onus and consequences on anyone who is texting and driving as I would on alcohol and or drugs. And that unfortunately is the only way to stop it, because everything else, we've had DARE, we've had alcohol programs, we've had everything under the sun, and nothing will stop people from drinking and driving and getting stoned and driving or texting and driving unless it's personally going to cost them more than they're willing to pay in the consequences.
Well, the texting and driving I see all the time.
I know. It's everywhere.
My son is a lawyer, and I don't think he can go to the bathroom without his cell phone on him so he can keep talking to people, you know, no matter what he's doing, where he is. And it bothers me greatly. But, you know, we put this kind of technology out there. And do we draw it back? Do we take away the ability to connect your phone to the car so that you can talk back and forth while you're driving? I mean, a lot of this stuff we've brought on ourselves. I mean, take away the tech and take away the possibilities and the potentialities, and then you have some control over some of it. But the driving drunk, you know, ever since alcohol, there's been people that are going to abuse it, and it's the same with marijuana, and it's the same with a lot of your other drugs. It's difficult to regulate things that are free out there for people who have no common sense to abuse.
Well, and that's the same reason why we put people in prison for killing people. If you murder somebody, homicide one, or even, you know, manslaughter two, you're going to pay a consequence. And if those people are not going to be personally accountable or personally responsible, then absolutely you have a consequence that is extraordinary. And as I said, strike one is the first time you drink and drive and you're caught. Whether it's a roadside catch or you're in an accident, automatic loss of your license for 5 years. You know, a $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 fine, and then when your car is impounded to make sure you don't drive it. It's, you know, and right on down the line, you make these things so harsh. You do the same thing with texting. So it will make people responsible. And the ones it doesn't make responsible, which is whatever percentage that is, they simply sit in a jail cell until they get their head straight.
What about this 14-year-old who was out driving around with his friends, and he obviously didn't have a license. He hit a car and he killed two people. I mean, you know, you have something like this. I mean, he wasn't even licensed to drive, and yet he has killed people. If you make an example of somebody like this, then this might work.
In Switzerland, there was a case last year. I'll just interject here. Just one little thought. It was really interesting. I read in the news last year, I guess, in Switzerland, some rich guy was speeding, and he got fined. I guess they fine them by a percentage of what they get paid every year. And so this guy got fined 300,000 something francs for speeding. So that's, I think, smart.
That's good. That's a good comment. You have to make the consequences more prohibitive and consequential than the freedom to go do the drinking and driving. I'm a litter picker upper. And one of the things, in fact, this morning I was just picking up on I-70 coming out of Denver. I live 35 miles from Denver, and there's two big rest stops where I live. Well, I live a minute from, and I'm always picking up literally what is my biggest pickup. Cases of empty Coors, cases of Pabst Blue Ribbon, cases of beer, bottles of wine, certainly whiskey bottles, all those little shooters that you get from the airports. Those are my biggest pickup of trash along the highway. So you can imagine all these people that are drinking and driving, and of course they toss their cans of or bottles and or shooters or their plastic whiskey bottles, and I'm telling you, it's extraordinary to me. Again, we're just not either brave enough or smart enough to make the consequences really harsh.
You know what might work? If a lot of the roads out here, I live in Connecticut, we used to have toll roads here. What if instead of, what about reinstating the tolls and instead of having them pay, have a breathalyzer every time you go through?
Well, that would be, that's like trying to fix the problem after the accident's already happened. Again, start the solution in the front end of the problem. In other words, you sign a piece of paper when you get your driver's license And this paper shows that you understand that if you drink and drive, you will lose your license for 5 years, your car for 5 years, you'll pay the impound fees, you'll pay the towing fees, and you're going to pay no less than $20,000 or $30,000 a year for insurance, which is mandatory once you get your license back after 5 years. And if you should drive in between time, you'll be sitting in jail. Again, make it so harsh that nobody would in their right mind. And then the ones that are out of their right mind, they're going to be sitting in a jail cell and or, you know, in a debtor prison for the rest of their lives. So that's, again, there must be another five solutions, but they've got to be very harsh.
Well, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm right there.
Okay, things went fuzzy for a minute there, and I haven't been drinking anything.
Well, I have to say here in Canada, driving has certainly gotten a lot worse, I've noticed, in the last few months since they legalized pot. I have to admit.
Oh, that's I've noticed here in Denver, Colorado.
I can imagine. It's crazy. And I saw, just the other day, we were at a kids' event, and man, the amount of adults smoking pot around their kids, it was probably at least maybe 100 adults there smoking pot. You couldn't get away from the cloud. It was just awful. I just thought, geez, I mean, isn't there any common sense here whatsoever? It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it.
Well, I would agree with you. Here's a quote from the United States National Highway Traffic Administration. Car accidents occur every minute of the day. Here's the quote. Motor vehicle accidents occur any part of the world every 60 seconds. And if it's all summed up on a yearly basis, there are 5.25 million driving accidents that take place annually in the United States. Statistics show that each year, 43,000 or more of the United States population die due to vehicular accidents, and around 2.9 million people end up suffering light or severe injuries. In a certain five-year period, there had been recorded that 25% of the driving population who encountered or were involved in car accidents. It also affirmed that car accidents kill a child in the United States every 3 minutes, unquote. So this, and here's the one for Canada, since you're in Canada. The Canada Free Press reported, and I'm quoting, here's one way to get attention. Traffic deaths worldwide kill the equivalent number of people as would perish in 9 jumbo jet crashes every year. Think of the headlines for 9 jet crashes every day of the year. World traffic injuries are taking the lives of 445 people every hour, every day, totaling 3,500 deaths per day. This is more than a minute and adds up to something like 1.3 million people dying on the world's highways and roads each year, and further 20 to 30 million people suffering injuries and often debilitating ones, unquote. That was from the Canada Free Press.
You know something, this goes right back to what this show, if Mark were here, was going to talk about, and it's depopulation. Do you think that they have not come down hard on the drinking and not come out, you know, and are making marijuana legal and stuff like that? Do you think that this is part of a depopulation program? Because it sure as hell sounds like it's working.
Well, I wouldn't. In the end, I don't think that there's any kind of harsh depopulation gang or a depopulation group. I've heard Agenda 21 from the United Nations and so forth. What I would like to see is that the world leaders, and I've said this before, get together at a national conference and an international conference, first a national conference in each country, and start talking about the fact that we need to gracefully, through birth control, lower the human population via one child per mother worldwide in the coming decades in order to bring the world population down to less than 1 billion so that we would have a viable a planet, viable biosphere, viable oceans, and viable environment so that we as the human race could thrive instead of what's going on. And for me, that would be a much more intelligent thing than creating some kind of a violent system where we die because we have so many people drinking alcohol or getting stoned or whatever.
It's probably just for profit. It's probably just for profit. I mean, you know, there's people making money off this stuff, so that's usually right. That's the only answer in the end.
Well, and that's the tragedy because no question about it, the beer companies make all their money and all the bars make all of their money. And everybody drives to all of these places to get all of this booze. And so there's no question that there is an extraordinary amount of irresponsibility and lack of personal accountability throughout not only the United States and Canada, but all over the world. So until we get a hold of that, then the rest of, and I don't drink personally, but the rest of us are going to pay the price with these statistics that I just gave you. That's a lot of people dying on the highways of the world.
Frosty, I'll give you a law enforcement's perspective. I retired about 3 years ago, but you know, the problem is all the budgetary constraints we have nowadays. And I remember just going call to call, and you really didn't have time to be taking yourself off the road for doing traffic control stuff. And, you know, that's just where I was at in a rural county setting. But did I make drunk driving arrest? Sure, you know, but it wasn't like when I first started where you could get three at night and no problem. I mean, our staffing got cut, everything else got cut, and that's pretty much all across the board. I mean, a lot of agencies I know, they were slaughtered, you know, in these budgetary times that we have. So you're doing the best you can with a skeleton crew, and you're trying to save your manpower to go to hot calls, you know, domestics, things like that. You see an increase in accidents and everything else because they know. They don't see as many police officers out there.
Well, thank you for your service as a police officer. And of course, my brother Howard was a police officer for 20 years, so I know all the same stories from my brother and the staffing, situations. And unfortunately, out there on the highways, there are really a lot of people. I mean, I hate to say this, but when you think about all the dumb kids that got through high school or the ones that dropped out of high school, and those kids grew into a world with a lack of personal accountability and a personal responsibility, they're susceptible in their lives from the fact that they're working a lousy job, they're not making much money, they're driving a lousy car, they're in a lousy situation. What's the nicest thing you can do? Well, you can get stoned and you can get drunk. And that kind of takes you away from your problems for a short amount of time. And obviously, we have millions of people out there on the highways doing it. And of course, the phenomenon of the smartphone and texting while you're going 70 miles an hour or 60 or 40 or 30. And in fact, when I pull up the stop signs or pull up the stoplights near my home, everybody, I'd say 9 out of 10 people are texting right there at the stop sign.
So and that's so hard to prove. Yeah, but you know that's the problem. When you're in a patrol car and it's fully marked, you don't see it as much. I see it all the time in an off-duty vehicle, you know. But when you're in a cruiser, people put that stuff away or they don't use it as much. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, because they can see. Well, right. That's where you need brown paper wrappers.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I used to be a over-the-road truck driver for United Van Lines in the summers. And boy, oh boy, I got to see a lot. And you, as a police officer, you got to see a lot. I mean, I saw every kind of crack up. I saw every kind of drug use. I saw 18 wheelers plow into bridges, into concrete abutments. I saw drivers go to sleep. I certainly went to all the truck stops. You know, Flying J, you name it, the truck stop whores. I mean, one of the things I think I got more education as a long haul trucker for United Van Lines in all the years I worked in the summers than I did any other way, because you really get to see humanity and how it operates. And so, you know, as a police officer, you know, and I've had other police officers I've talked to, because I talk to a lot of the guys I work out at gym, and they're already still police officers, and also of EMTs that I work out with. I know I made a very didactic, if you will, statement on how to cure drunk driving and texting and certainly marijuana usage and so forth. you as a police officer, does that seem like something that would work, or is there something else that you would have that would be better, or is it a hopeless situation and that human nature is going to win out in the end and people are going to drink no matter what and they're going to get stoned no matter what and they're going to text no matter what?
That's an interesting question, because I look at it and say, when things get the worst, right, when the economy tanks, what's the one thing that keeps selling? Booze, you know? I mean,
well, more so, because right? You can under trouble.
Right. So, I mean, it's just that cause and effect loop coming into it, you know, where you have more and more people. You know, what we need is to get to the root of the problem, and what's that? You know, you got to be able to think properly. You got to be able to live your life properly. And it just gets more and more difficult with more and more stressors that we have.
You know, that's one of the things, you know, as a former teacher that I found, and I have found now as I've, you know, lived through my life, and I'm looking back on it, I mean, I still think I have 10 more years, a pretty viable life, and I'm thankful for that. And I just went skiing yesterday. I went bicycling today after I worked out and went swimming. But for me, at some point, that's correct. The stressors are there, and they're getting more stressful, and the world is going faster, and the computers are driving us a little more crazy as we go. And again, for me, whether it's in Canada or whether it's in America or literally anywhere, somehow we have got to move as civilizations, as countries, as cities and communities. We really, I think, have to get back to basics. And the basics are body, mind, and spirit. You've got to take care of your body, number one, and feed it and exercise it. And you also have to mind. You've got to go to the mind. You've got to feed the mind. You've also got to choose or be able to choose a job that fits your highest and best as a human being, so that you're a happy human being. I think we need to get to that in the high schools, even in grade schools, so that we help move individuals toward living an intellectual life as best that they can, toward the best that they can academically. Because I taught in the elementary, I taught in high school, and I taught in college, and then move toward a job or an academic future where you're happy. And when you're happy, you're not out there being irresponsible. You're actually being responsible and accountable, because that's the way your life needs to go. And then, of course, the spiritual aspect, body, mind, and spirit, however each person takes life on spiritually, whether it's religion or whether it's Buddhism or whether it's agnosticism, I really don't care. But as long as they keep a balance, and so they're not out there drinking their brains out because they're unhappy, or they're not stoned because they don't have anything else to do. So
if you can live a virtuous life, whether whatever your faith is or belief structure, if you're living by a virtuous life, well, that's, to me, the cure. You know what I mean? We can look at penalties and we can look at all these things, but in the end, does that always work? No. But if we can get people to think properly and have a good outlook on life and lead a virtuous life, well, I think we might get more results. But
no, I think you're absolutely right. But where does it have to start? Because you have a society today that is not functioning that way.
Right.
So you have to start with the children. And the schools, I taught school for 25 years as well. So the school systems are set up to dumb our kids down. So you're going to have to change the whole school system to start working towards where their talents and gifts are and enhancing those, so that you raise happy, functional adults at some point in time. Because you can't start with, it would be a good idea too. I know there are adults out there that are trying to get into the body, mind, spirit balance, and they're doing a great job. But it's a small number of people. And in order to put this into practice, and I think you're absolutely dead on with what it will take to create a society that way, but you have to start real young, and the school system is something that the government isn't going to let you touch.
You know, I grew up in a very small town in Canada, and it was very different when I was a kid growing up. People would come here, and it was a lot less stressful. The real estate was a lot cheaper. You know, people could just have a good job and pay off their bills and whatever, and not just live for that. But nowadays, you have to have 10 roommates just to manage two jobs, you know, and that just two crappy jobs. And it's just not the world I grew up in at all. And I can definitely see there's a huge difference. And it's not just an economy thing. It's definitely, you know, there's more people and there's less place to put them anymore. And so they're scrounging, you know, trying to find places for them. And the places that are left over are not as nice as the ones that, you know, when the people first started coming here and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, the stresses I see, you know, like I was a musician growing up and I was able to practice, you know, because I lived out in the boonies and there was no neighbors. But the kids that I grew up with, a lot of them lived in town, you know, townhouses and that sort of thing. They couldn't practice music. And, you know, it just, it definitely affected their life, like hugely. Like they, it's just so concrete, the results out of overpopulation and just being stuck together in these communities, you know, and this sort of thing. It just doesn't function. It doesn't work. People can't really grow up to be neutral, to be themselves, to be trying things. And out, you know, I was driving a truck when I was 9 years old, you know, on the fields with, you know, getting oats off the fields, oat bundles and stuff with a big trailer. And, you know, you just don't see that in the, you don't get those kinds of experiences. You don't see what it's like to go hunting and to respect the natural cycles of things so that you can go back next year and still be able to enjoy it rather than destroying it all, or, you know, all those kinds of things. If that's not there, fat chance. You know, you won't be able to understand intrinsically what really happens in the natural laws. So when I first went to Vancouver for the first time, it blew my mind. I thought, how the hell can these cities even exist? And to think that Vancouver is tiny compared to a lot of cities out there. And there's so many of them. And I just thought, how the hell can this function? It's just it can't function. There's no way it can. There's no way it can. So here we have still, you know, pretty relatively small town, but, you know, the sewer system's overflowing and they don't know what to do. The whole town stinks half the time whenever the wind blows a certain direction. And, you know, all this kind of stuff is going on. And I just think to myself, my God, I mean, this is not the design of intelligent people. You know, this is just people living their stupid lives, doing stupid things, and they don't even question what they're doing. They're just doing it, and it's just unbelievable. So, yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
As an old farm boy myself, and I was driving that old 49B John Deere tractor, and know that hard work thing myself, and cutting the chickens' heads off after you fed them and raised them, and all that goes with that, and plucking them. You get common sense, but you also get purpose, and you also get a grounding in nature, and you get, you know, the seasons come and go, and there's no question, but you look at the big cities, let's face it, cities are completely, and John Muir said it way back in 1891 in some of his writings, there's not a perfectly sane man in all of San Francisco, it's because everything is cabled and taught. And because it's so taught, everybody's strung up and they're a little bit insane. And so these kids are growing up in the middle of these concrete jungles. They think milk comes from a carton. They think food comes, and they don't even know what food is. It's just something that they buy or whatever. And they're not in touch with the natural world. They're not in touch with themselves. And their biorhythms are completely out of whack. And so what do they do? Well, they get stoned, they get drunk, they smoke cigarettes, they do any kind of drugs they can, because they were already crazy in the first place as they were growing up. So, you know, I'm glad that we have, some of us have been teachers and certainly have come off that farm, because one of my most thankful things is I'm a farm boy in Michigan. I came off the farm. I worked my tail feathers off, you know, and I got to go to college and had a sense of self. And I had good parents who were balanced. So we need to teach, like, parents that are going to have, you know, kids. They need to have parenting classes. We need to have kids grow up with the choices to go into something that is meaningful to them. Because In fact, Dan Millman wrote The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. He's been a friend of mine for 25 years. And there are 37 pathways to life. And literally, I'd say 80-plus percent of high school students get out of high school. They stagger into life. They stagger through high school. They stagger into life. And they don't know what they're doing or how to get where they want to go because they have no clue. I would like to see more teaching in high schools on how to move towards your most productive life. As a matter of fact, I wrote a book about it. It's called Living Your Spectacular Life, and I give 12 concepts and practices on how to move toward what turns you on, what makes you feel whole, what makes you feel good, what gives you balance. And I think we need more of that teaching so that all these kids that are so lost and so staggering into their late teens have a chance to find out what makes them a productive, positive, accountable, and responsible person. Does that make sense?
Of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I was certainly not coming out of high school in flying colors at all. Actually, I dropped out. So, and I was suicidal and everything else, you know. But I avoided the drugs and the alcohol, thank goodness. For the most part, I drank a little bit, but after high school, and that was just a couple times, you know, to get the buzz going for the music. But realized it didn't work after the second night. So yeah, got over that pretty quick. And I totally hear you, man. And I wish it was easier to find that stuff. I really had to work my tail off just to find what you're talking about. And I found it in my own way. And if you heard any of the other shows, but anyway, it doesn't matter. It's still, you know, it's something that should be easier to find in our world, and it's just so lacking. And I find even a lot of my family members, you know, and so on, friends that I grew up with in high school and so on, that, you know, I can't stand being around them just because they're just dead from the neck up, you know, and they're totally into the drugs and they're totally into the alcohol and all that stuff, and they're not doing anything with their life. They're having the same conversations, exactly the same conversations that they had 15 years ago, and I can't believe it. It's really hard to believe. It's hard to watch.
Well, it's painful, especially when you know, I've gone back to my 55th reunion and all that goes with it. And the ones that did poorly lived very poor lives. They were, you know, cashiers at a Three Blonde diner in the sticks and never got out of that. And they get to watch TV and see all the extraordinary stuff going on TV, but they never got to participate themselves. And the rest of them were used car salesmen and or truck drivers and or, you know, meaningless jobs that just simply got a paycheck. And so there's no question we need to get into the educational fields and actually educate children from first grade on up to move toward their highest and best, and what is their contribution and what is their best contribution because of those 37 pathways of life. And wouldn't that be fantastic? But of course, unfortunately, we've got all the money being spent on the military. I mean, my God, the money that's spent on the military here in the United States is beyond sickening. And all the absurd wars that we're fighting, whether it was from Vietnam, whether it was Korea, those are all bankers' wars, and big people with big money have all the power. Same thing going on with Afghanistan and Iraq and the next war that they're planning, you know. And so I think in the end it has to be at the individual level, in education, at the community level, and in the states and the provinces of each country. And we've got to get a handle on it locally, and I guess that to me is about the only way we're going to be able to solve it. And I'm not sure that we have the fortitude or the wisdom enough to do that. It's obviously not happening across both Canada and America right now.
Well, I got to run, but you guys keep chatting. It's fantastic talking to you.
Oh,
nice to meet you. My name's Daniel.
Thank you.
I
hope this conversation that people are listening to, you know, across the country, across Canada, I hope we create discussions. I hope there's folks that are listening to this that have an understanding and then start talking at the diners and talking at the city councils. I'm going to my city council here in another week and trying to get the golden population stabilization policy passed. And boy, they're sitting there with their deer in the headlights. They can't even imagine. And I said, well, do you keep wanting more gridlock traffic? Do you want to have more air pollution with every breath that you're breathing? Do you want to be crammed and jammed in the streets of Golden, Colorado, like they are in Denver? And they're going, yeah, we don't, you know, do we want to have I-70 gridlocks so nobody can go camping or skiing on the weekends? But to get them to move on that is like trying to move, I feel like I'm Sisyphus.
It's like trying to raise the Titanic with tweezers, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I hear you.
Well, you know, as we come into the finish of this consequences of overpopulation, and certainly on so many levels, this is Jason Brent from Los Angeles, Nevada, a friend of mine. He's a demographic expert, and he said, and I'm quoting here, and he said, so what's the answer? Therefore, the only problem, the ultimate problem facing humanity is to reduce our population as quickly as possible with the least amount of death and destruction, and to determine who will be permitted to produce when the population contraction commences in the very near future. He's talking about human die-off because of starvation rates. Compared to the problem described above, every other problem faced by humanity is irrelevant and unimportant. If the problem described above is not solved, billions will die due to the decline of economic activity, loss of oil, and or which will cause continuous wars and other horrors until the population is reduced to the level of the declining economic activity that can support it, unquote. We talked about it last week. We keep going on this path. There's no question. It's an absolute guaranteed biological fact that these civilizations will collapse at some point, and we and or our kids will be in those civilizations. And I would say it's a whole lot smarter to be proactive and productive in preventing that by taking another path, by choosing another route in order to get to the future. And of course, as I said, we need to go to one child per woman worldwide, and it needs to be agreed upon by all the world leaders and all the environmentalists, and especially all of the religious leaders around the world, because if they don't, and we don't, then the Darwin solution, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, will be the solution that's going to engage us whether we like it or not.
How will you enforce something like that? I mean,
again, I don't think we can enforce it. What I'm hoping is a national, international discussion that we bring to the religious leaders and all the environmental leaders and then all the world leaders, say that, hey, the human race needs to have one child per woman worldwide starting now, and that's what we need to move toward, and we have to do it intelligently. Because if we don't, then again, I don't think we can enforce it, but I think if we get it on the plate and we start advertising it and we start using all of the powers of education, because your first world countries are already there. The first world countries have always, since 1970, they've been having only two children or less per woman. And so it's possible to do it. And so, again, it has to be the educated countries have to lead. And then the trickle-down effect, if you will, into the other countries. And as their consequences grow, and those consequences are going to grow, we're going to add another 3 billion people here in the next 30 years around the planet. Somebody's going to get a clue that, hey, we can't keep going on this path.
I hear what you're saying, and it makes sense. It's just you think of places where there is no birth control. There is, I'm thinking third world countries here.
Right.
Preventing them from, if you get all of the educated countries doing this, then you have a mass of uneducated people that are going to go wacko with it. And before you know it, you're going to have a global confrontation of, you know, the haves and the haves nots, and the have nots are going to have a lot more than the haves.
There's no question we're going to have global confrontation, and it's already coming at us. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. It's coming.
All right. Thank you so much, Frosty, for your wisdom, and Barbara, we appreciate it.
Barbara,
we're
going to
be closing out the show today, and I want to thank Solana Daniel as well. Thanks.